And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, the Mighty Boo on your Thursday morning with just a minute before 9 o'clock. Coming up in a half hour on A Deeper Look, host Linda Olsen Osterlund interviews Victoria Brittain about her book Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. At 10, hear Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, internationally celebrated writer and political analyst Michael Parenti on his new memoir, Waiting for Yesterday. And Aurora Levin Morales talks about her new book, Kindling, Writings on the Body. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Jim Schumach interviews Katie Schultz about her new book, Flashes of War, which captures personal moments of fear, introspection, confusion, and valor in one collection spanning nations and perspectives. And at 11:30 today on The Film Show, today they present a freewheeling conversation with former Portlander Penny Allen, who helped kickstart Portland's independent film scene in the 1970s. In addition to Oregon film history, we'll be discussing her newest feature, Late for My Mother's Funeral, which screens at the Northwest Film Center on December 16th. But first, it is Press Watch with news you're not supposed to know. Teresa Mitchell is coming up next on KBOO.
Listen to The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of each month at 11:30 a.m. The Film Show features news and interviews about the local and independent film scene. That's The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of the month at 11:30 a.m., only on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know, giving you the tools to destroy billionaire rule. Brought my Geiger counter this morning. Right up here. Let's see. See if a few radionuclides will speak for us. Come on, tick for me. There it goes. Come on, radionuclide. Oh man, you have to be listening. See, they get shy when you. It's nice and radionuclide free here, I guess, in the studio at KBOO. I took my Geiger counter, my little book, to a local sushi restaurant again, and I registered a low of 9 counts per minute on some tuna. That's pretty good because, as you may know, tuna has been picked up all over the Pacific with cesium in it. But I did get a high of 17 counts per minute of salmon, and I picked up a spike at 26 counts per minute on some dirty plates, and I never did figure out exactly what made it go up that high. But I didn't pick up anything that would make the Geiger counter rattle. There's a nice click for you. Come on, click again for me. They get shy. Anyway, so things are nice and cool here in Portland, relatively speaking. Now, of course, the salmon is getting to be more of a problem because salmon migrate as tuna do, and Alaska salmon have been getting gradually hotter, and just because I can go into a restaurant with a Geiger counter doesn't mean that I'm actually determining that things are safe. I mean, for example, if that salmon is showing 17 counts per minute and would otherwise show 15 if it didn't have a little bit of cesium or strontium in it, then, you know, that cesium And strontium, once you actually consume it and absorb it into your body, well, cesium heads to your heart and strontium heads to your bones, and this can have an effect. Right now, as I've passed along on this show in previous months, there is an undersea current which is doing us on the West Coast a favor, and it is directing some of the undersea flow of radionuclides from the Fukushima nuclear power disaster somewhere off the coast of Hawaii, well off the coast. I shouldn't even use the word coast. It's a deep sea current. And that is delaying some of the worst effects. However, the crisis is ongoing. All of that crap is slowly washing down into the sea bit by bit as the tanks leak and the underground water flows past the melting corium, which is doing a gradual China syndrome there. KBOO's Paul Roland has been in the forefront of the effort to direct international efforts toward Fukushima's ongoing disaster. He told me he wrote Harvey Wasserman about the issue, and I didn't get the details and don't know whether the recent article published by Wasserman was in direct response, but he did publish an article which is very relevant, and you can find it in a couple of places, including globalresearch.ca. He wrote, "We are now within 2 months of what may be humankind's most dangerous moment since the Cuban Missile Crisis. There is no excuse for not acting. All the resources our species can muster must be focused on the fuel pool at Fukushima Unit 4. Fukushima's owner, Tokyo Electric, or TEPCO, says that within as few as 60 days, it may begin trying to remove the more than 1,300 spent fuel rods from a badly damaged pool perched 100 feet in the air. The pool rests on a badly damaged building that is tilting, sinking, and could easily come down in the next earthquake, if not on its own. Some 400 tons of fuel in that pool could spew out more than 15,000 times as much radiation as was released at Hiroshima. The one thing certain about this crisis is that TEPCO does not have the scientific, engineering, or financial resources to handle it, nor does the Japanese government. The situation demands a coordinated worldwide effort of the best scientists and engineers our species can muster. Why is this so serious? We already know that thousands of tons of heavily contaminated water are pouring through the Fukushima site, carrying a devil's brew of long-lived poisonous isotopes into the Pacific. Tuna irradiated with fallout traceable to Fukushima have already been caught off the coast of California. We can expect far worse. TEPCO continues to pour more water onto the proximate site of the three melted reactor cores. It must somehow keep cool. Steam plumes indicate fission may still be going on somewhere underground, but nobody knows exactly where those cores actually are. And speaking for myself, you can't afford to go find out because the radiation from them is so intense it'll kill you just to look at them. And it'll stop your machines when you get them close enough. But to return to what Harvey Wasserman has written, much of that irradiated water now sits in a roughly 1,000 huge but fragile tanks that have been quickly assembled and strewn about the site. Many are already leaking. All could shatter in the next earthquake, releasing thousands of tons of permanent poisons into the Pacific. The water flowing through the site is also undermining the remnant structures at Fukushima, including the one supporting the fuel pool at Unit 4. More than 6,000 fuel assemblies now sit in a common pool just 15 meters from Unit 4. Some contain plutonium. That's a whole nother story. But returning to the text here, the pool has no containment over it. It's vulnerable to loss of coolant, the collapse of a nearby building, another earthquake, another tsunami, and more. Overall, more than 11,000 fuel assemblies are scattered around the Fukushima site. According to longtime expert and former Department of Energy official Robert Alvarez, there is more than 85 times as much lethal cesium on site as was released at Chernobyl. And Wasserman also writes, radioactive hotspots continue to be found around Japan. There are indications of heightened rates of thyroid damage among local children. The immediate bottom line is that those fuel rods must somehow come safely out of the Unit 4 fuel pool as soon as possible. Just prior to the 3/11/11 earthquake and tsunami that shattered the Fukushima site, the core of Unit 4 was removed for routine maintenance and refueling, Like some 24 reactors in the U.S. and too many more around the world, the General Electric-designed pool into which that core now sits is 100 feet in the air. Spent fuel must somehow be kept underwater. It's clad in zirconium alloy, which will spontaneously ignite when exposed to air. Long used in flash bulbs for cameras, zirconium burns with an extremely bright, hot flame. Each uncovered rod emits enough radiation to kill someone standing nearby in a matter of minutes. A conflagration could force all personnel to flee the site and render electronic machinery unworkable. According to Arne Gunderson, a nuclear engineer with 40 years in an industry for which he once manufactured fuel rods, the ones in Unit 4 core are bent, damaged, and embrittled to the point of crumbling. Cameras have shown troubling quantities of debris in the fuel pool, which itself is damaged. The engineering and scientific barriers to emptying the Unit 4 fuel pool are unique and daunting, says Gunderson, but must be done to 100% perfection. Should the attempt fail, the rods could be exposed to air and catch fire, releasing horrific quantities of radiation into the atmosphere and departing from the text. Much more than has already been released. This is the big problem at Fukushima, and the situation is getting worse. But returning to the article, the pool could come crashing to the ground, dumping the rods together into a pile that could fission and possibly explode. The resulting radioactive cloud would threaten the health and safety of all of us. Chernobyl's first 1986 fallout reached California within 10 days. Fukushima's in 2011 arrived in less than a week. A new fuel fire at Unit 4 would pour out a continuous stream of lethal radioactive poisons for centuries. Former Ambassador Mitsui Murata says that full-scale releases from Fukushima would destroy the world environment and our civilization. This is not rocket science, nor does it connect to the pugilistic debate over nuclear power plants. This is an issue of human survival, end quote. Neither Tokyo Electric nor the government of Japan can go this alone. There's no excuse for deploying anything less than a coordinated team of the planet's best scientists and engineers. We have 2 months or less to act. For now, we are petitioning the United Nations and President Obama to mobilize the global scientific and engineering community to take charge at Fukushima and the job of moving these fuel rods to safety. You can sign the petition at nukefree.org. If you have a better idea, he writes, please follow it, but do something and do it now. The clock is ticking. The hand of global nuclear disaster is painfully close to midnight. That's from Harvey Wasserman. And I have some moderately good news regarding that. From FukushimaDiary.com today, in the regular press briefing yesterday, the chairman of the Japanese Nuclear Regulation Authority, Mr. Tanaka, stated that the head of the Secretary of the International Atomic Energy Agency strongly requested that the Japanese authorities set up an international system to evaluate the Pacific contamination situation. Mr. Tanaka has just come back from the IAEA conference in Vienna. He commented that currently the Pacific contamination data, that means Fukushima, is collected by several Japanese institutes such as the NRA. That's not the American NRA, but rather the Japanese Nuclear Regulation Authority, TEPCO, the Fukushima Prefecture Government, etc. The newly founded system will be to evaluate the data and share the understandings among the international community. No details were announced about the management or organization of the proposed International Fukushima Watchdog Agency. Now, that's surely not enough, but it is a start, and it's rather different. It's a rather different attitude and a direction from TEPCO. Also from Fukushima Diary, and this from memory, forgive me, but there's one of the stacks. I guess you'd call them smokestacks, unfortunately. Really smoke and steam stacks. Now, next to one of those broken reactors has big rust spots on it, about 66, I think they said 66 meters or maybe 66 feet, about a third of the way up. Big, tall stack. Huge marks rusting. It looks like the thing's going to bend over and collapse. That would be extremely bad news and could precipitate an even greater crisis there, not greater than the one that I'm referring to here. This situation with Unit 4 has been going on. We've been warned about it for years now. This really is one of the worst things hanging over the survival of humanity right now. If that thing were to go, the cloud coming over here would really be serious. It would sicken us. And, it's pretty hard to exaggerate. how bad it could be. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Came in and saw books and records and tapes, comics. It's almost time for the KBOO book and record sale. And this year, evidently, from what I can see here and from talking with the staff, this is going to be, I guess, the biggest one we've ever had. It's absolutely huge. And the quality of stuff coming in is just astonishing. You still have time to bring in your books and records, by the way, if you want to donate. This is fantastic news for those of you who love books, records, tapes, comics. This thing's going to be this weekend at 325 Northeast 20th, Saturday. And let's see, is it also Sunday? Maybe someone can correct me on that. 325 Northeast 20th, that's the Musicians Union Hall. It's a half block from Sandy Boulevard. 325 Northeast 20th. Just go to Sandy and 20th and you'll be able to see the Musicians Union Hall off. Well, let's see, it's just south of Sandy. The vinyl is astonishing. The selection, you know, over the years I've gone to the book and record sale and I've found things that are just amazing, things that you won't likely encounter elsewhere. I found a tape from an English-speaking Tibetan Bonpo Buddhist shaman, and it was quite a tape. And I found, along those same lines, I found a pamphlet in Portuguese for sorcerers. I found all sorts of records. The vinyl there is just amazing. Vinyl is really coming back these days. Of course, you can buy new turntables that use lasers to and microchips to read records that would be too scratched to otherwise play. But these records, some of them are just fantastic things in wonderful condition and very collectible. And there's so much we don't know what's there, and we can't know. But it's a huge, huge book and record sale. I encourage you to contribute and or to go to the sale. And I think it's going to be a big thing, a big gathering. We're going to have music. We're going to have a bake sale going on at the same time. It's going to be very festive. And again, judging from the stacks and stacks of books, records, tapes, comics, DVDs, etc. here, it's going to be a blast and really something to see. So come on in. Press Watch on KBOO Portland. If you bought $200 worth of groceries in 2007, you could purchase those same groceries for $225.60 now, according to the Inflation Calculator Service on the Bureau of Labor Statistics website. I mention this because, as you know, the economy began to collapse. The engineer comes in with a note, says, caller asks, please repeat Harvey Wasserman website info. Well, I found that article. Harvey Wasserman has his own website, nukefree.org, I believe it is. But you can find that particular article at globalresearch.ca. But as I was saying, inflation's been creeping on, and it's been creeping up on your pocketbook. $200 worth of groceries in 2007, you can purchase those same groceries for $225.60 now. And that's according to the Inflation Calculator Service on the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics website. The economy began to collapse, as we know, in 2008, and we know why, and practically no one has as much money as they did then, except the 1%, of course. But for the 99% for you and me, since our incomes have plummeted, and since in correlation, demand is down for the products we need, the law of supply and demand should have produced deflation, not inflation. You should be able to buy more groceries for $200 since 2007, not less. What happened? Well, here's the economic news you're not supposed to know. The value of the dollar has been sapped by the Federal Reserve and the Treasury giveaways to the super rich called quantitative easing. That's the same quantitative easing that recently was in the news because there was just a slight gesture that maybe Bernanke was going to say, we're going to taper it off a little bit. And the banksters had a fit, and he backed up on that. They're not going to taper off quantitative easing one bit. Billions and billions of dollars every single month given away from the Treasury and the Fed to the super rich. It will not stop. And it is destroying the dollar. How could it not? Trillions have been printed up as gifts to billionaires. The official excuse was that, they were going to lend out the money. Ha, they never did. Lending's down. They can make much more money doing derivatives gambling. Do you know how much money you need to get your toe into derivatives gambling? Wouldn't you like to get those super profits? Well, if you've got $20 million, you can get in the door. No kidding. $20 million, absolute minimum. Super, super rich. The result is, after several years, there is far more cash chasing the same amount of goods. Therefore, prices have risen, of course. The Great Gatsby giveaway is an indirect tax on you as the value of your paycheck shrinks with the dollar. Still think the banks are too big to fail and too good to jail? Do ya? Speaking of tyranny, this from pandaunite.org. That's the people against the NDAA. In an effort to restore the United States Constitution and Bill of Rights, 11th Ward Councilman of Albany, New York, Anton Konev, has introduced Resolution 80.92.13. The strongest resolution in the nation designed to protect Albany's citizens from the application of Sections 1021 and 1022 of the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, or the Law of War, in the city of Albany. And I mention this from pandaunite.org because we could do the same thing here in Portland, and in fact the entire nation needs to do it. Because, well, let me read further from it. The 2012 National Defense Authorization Act was overwhelmingly passed by Congress and signed into law by President Barack Obama on December 31st, 2011. Remember that? The 2012 NDAA declares the United States to be a battlefield in the war on terror. And Sections 1021 and 1022 authorize the indefinite detention without charge or trial of all persons on U.S. soil accused by the president of undefined support for terrorist activity or commission of a belligerent act. This violates multiple provisions of the U.S. Constitution, including the 1st, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th, and 14th Amendments. People against the NDAA, or PANDA, a national, nonpartisan grassroots organization founded in January 2012, is committed to reversing the NDAA's unconstitutional authorizations with activism to affect policy at the level of state and local government. PANDA started in Bowling Green, Ohio, and has since expanded into 30 state teams nationwide. If the resolution in New York is adopted by Albany's City Common Council, law enforcement in Albany will be required to interpose between the U.S. military or similar agencies and Albany residents under the NDAA's special provisions or under any interpretation of presidential authority permitting detention of U.S. residents without trial under the law of war. New York's state and federal legislators, its governor, and its attorney general will be notified of the city's determination that local and federal officers will obey the letter of the Constitution and allow due process, including trial, to all Albany residents. That's the end of it. You can read more at pandaunite.org. And I think that's a wonderful idea. And I do think that law enforcement means enforcing the Constitution. What we got left? If we don't have habeas corpus, what we got left? I've had a lot of different thoughts this week, and it's wonderful to be here on KBOO. If you pull up the PortlandTribune.com, you'll find an article by Bruce Silverman that speaks to what KBOO is about and where we're going. And I am so proud and so grateful to be a part of this. Changing topics a bit, someone needs to say to the gun lobby particularly, and to all the men who worship guns, that it is unmanly to have a temper tantrum with a firearm. It's unmanly, and by that statement, I do not propose to accept all or even a major part of the ridiculously constrictive gender construction that binds us, men and women, boys and girls, to a diminished human experience. No, but I want to use it like a judo student uses the momentum of her attacker. What is manliness? If it's something apart from boyishness, from childishness, then it has something to do with maturity, one would hope, and there is nothing manly, nothing glorious about having a tantrum with an AR-15 or a shotgun or a Glock or whatever. A tantrum is a tantrum is a tantrum. A suicidal, homicidal, femicidal tantrum is still a tantrum, and it is unmanly. The gun masker business in our world has to do with men, or rather with a grotesquely deformed puerility in some men. It has to do with a culture that celebrates every day and every cop show on TV the glorious rightness of some snarling guy puncturing someone else with a firearm. These endless Hollywood fantasies, which sell not only cars and soap, but millions of firearms, must be confronted. The thundering explosion of the pistol has in the minds of millions of U.S. citizens become a shortcut to ending frustration. People laughingly mime a gunshot when discussing a particularly frustrating person or situation. You've seen it. You've done it. I have. What if the implement of homicide were changed? Would it become glorified like guns are after generations of TV dramas? Instead of the rifleman, we'd have the poisoner. Magnum P.I. would become Garrote Wire P.I. Or maybe we'd have Stabby McStabberton P.I. I lived for decades as a man. I remember well, though it's been a dozen years, the pressure men feel to have at least the potential for some sort of daunting violence. I have a rifle. It's not for winning arguments, nor for aiding me in resolving any sort of frustration with anyone ever. I am not a man. But if I were, the role of this rifle would not change. Manliness should not be about gun violence. A mature person, even a mature man, does not solve problems with a fit of violence. Whatever the problem is, he says to himself, I can handle this, and there's a way to make this right, or else accept and even grieve, oh my God, grieve, that sometimes things are wrong and can't be changed. A mature person accepts that life can be difficult, even painful and terrifying and certainly frustrating. A grown man does not give in to tantrums. A mature man does not have tantrums. It will take a visible mass movement from mature men to remove the media glorification from the mass murderer, to show that these are mere boys, toddlers in emotional development. The same goes for guys that murder their girlfriends and then kill themselves. They're not tragic figures who gave in to despair. They're pitiful, immature, unmanly boys. Can we agree on that? So how about it, gun-identified guys? Can you agree among yourselves to stand up to the tantrum throwers? Will you denounce gun intimidation among yourselves when no women are present? Of course, that might bring up all sorts of questions about manliness and about getting your way via intimidation. But manly men are brave, right? So take the oath, gun guys. I will never use my gun to prove a point. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. And winding up here, hope you'll stay tuned for a closer look. I am very skeptical that there is really a pause in the war preparations. For example, this from DefenseNews.com, the U.S. Navy has deployed a fifth destroyer to the Eastern Mediterranean. A defense official told Agence France-Presse on Thursday, the Stout, a guided missile destroyer, is in the Mediterranean, heading and moving east to relieve the Mahan. Other destroyers in the region, the Ramage, the Berry, and the Gravely, or Gravely, or whatever you call it, crisscross the Mediterranean, could launch their Tomahawk missiles towards Syria if so directed by President Barack Obama. So they're still out there. The Harry S. Truman Carrier Strike Group, this is from Jacksonville.com, relieved the Nimitz CSG in the Arabian Sea August 26, assuming the duties as Commander Task Force CTF-50. Why are they there? From Stripes.com, which is the website that used to be Stars and Stripes, the USS San Antonio, an amphibious ship carrying hundreds of Marines, arrived Wednesday in Haifa, Israel, amid regional tensions over possible U.S. military strikes against Syria. The ship is part of the Kearsarge Amphibious Ready Group, which left the East Coast in March for routine deployment to Middle East and Europe. In other words, there are thousands and thousands of soldiers. There are dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds, of U.S. ships in the region. The impending war is certainly not over. Stay tuned to KBOO Portland for more of the news you're not supposed to know.
Cascadia. Half an hour of news in 15 minutes.
Weekdays at 10 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. It's the end of the news as you know it.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to A Deeper Look. I'm your host, Linda Olson Osterlund. Our topic today is the forgotten women of the War on Terror. That is also the subtitle of my guest's book. She's Victoria Britton, journalist and former associate editor for The Guardian newspaper. And as a research associate for the London School of Economics, she traveled through conflict areas in Africa and Europe, investigating the impact of those conflicts on the women there. She's the author of several books, including Hidden Lives, Hidden Deaths, Death of Dignity, and this, her most recent, released just this year, Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. Welcome to KBOO, Victoria Britton.
Thank you so much.
I'm so happy to have you here with us. I spent the last few days reading your book and really very much enjoyed it. I felt like I actually was in the living rooms and kitchens and on some of those horrible trips to the prisons with these women. And so I really appreciate the, you know, it just felt like you were inside there with them through all this. And it was really a good way to read the book. So thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you for having that response. That's exactly what the women would like to hear, that non-Muslim women who have never really thought about